My, it's dark out there. It won't be much longer. You're going to be in a room that is filled with more light than you have ever seen in a church. All our visitors are welcome. I met only one of them this morning, Mark Chase, Ted and Shirley's son, visiting from Denver. We're probably not quite as happy to have him here as they are, but we are delighted. 50 years ago, a momentous thing happened. A little baby came into this world with a round, joyous face and curly hair. He was named Walter Myers. And he grew up to play the trumpet. Walt is celebrating number 50 today. Offer him congratulations or condolences as you feel appropriate. Sermon titles read on church bulletin boards as you zip past in your car often seem to have very little relevance to what we like to call real life. If you had read in the bulletin last week that the sermon title for this Sunday would be "Whatever Happened to Ethics," you'd have said to yourself, well, that's a predictable sermon topic. I can guess what that talk will be like. So it was a surprise a few days ago when some of us picked up the current issue of a popular Newsweekly magazine and saw in huge block letters on the cover the title of the feature story, "Whatever Happened to Ethics?" And then as we read it, we began to feel we were in church, hearing a sermon, only this time it was not coming from preachers, but from politicians and philosophers, from business executives and sociologists, all of them sounding surprisingly like the biblical prophets. It may or may not last long. It may or may not produce significant change. But there is an anxious, deeply concerned mood among the most thoughtful people in this country. What has them upset is suggested by the rest of that cover story title on Time's first page. Assaulted by sleaze, scandals, and hypocrisy, America searches for its moral bearings. Before we hear more about it, let's listen one more time to the words Allison read from Scripture a moment ago. Anyone who puts love for father or mother above love for me does not deserve to be my disciple. And the person who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Now those are either the words of an egomaniac who couldn't bear not to be number one on everybody's love list, or else they mean something like this. You have to have some convictions you will not violate, not even for your father or your mother. You have to have some principles which not even your love for your son or daughter can cause you to forsake. In other words, your first loyalty, believe it or not, is not to your family. Your first loyalty is to something called integrity, without which your love of family is very likely to turn rancid. Nor is your first loyalty to yourself, despite the modern gospel of individualism. The person who concentrates on gaining life for himself, Jesus says, will only lose it. But the person who loses himself for my sake will find life. What it means is that if you head for all you can get, grabbing frantically for every ring you pass on the merry-go-round, you wind up losing something far more valuable than anything you got. While the person who refuses to do certain things because of principle will be filled with self-respect and serenity beyond the world's power to destroy. So let's go back to the magazine and put those words against some of the case histories that open the story. A widely admired investment banker with a yearly salary said to be in excess of $1 million sneaks into Wall Street alleys to sell insider tips, for which he later collects a briefcase stuffed with $700,000. Savings and loan officers in Texas, all with six-figure salaries and bonuses, loot their institution to buy Rolls Royces and trips to Paris. A defense contractor with $11 billion, not million, but $11 billion in annual sales to the government, charges the government over $1,000 for the plastic cap on the leg of a stool. More than 100 members of the present administration have had ethical or legal charges leveled against them, a number said to be without precedent in American history. Deaver indicted for perjury, Donovan for defrauding the New York City Transit Authority, the first cabinet member, I think, to win such a distinction, Edwin Meese and Lynn Nofziger, both under investigation by special prosecutors for helping a corporation in ways that are not legal, Ann Burford and Rita Lavelle, bumped from office for bending environmental regulations for some of their friends who were industrial polluters, high officials sworn to follow the Constitution who decide when they don't like a law passed by Congress that they will simply find ways to circumvent it. In the magazines and books I'm reading, there is a deepening sense of alarm about what this means for American life. It seems only yesterday that Ronald Reagan was telling us that America was back. Back from the agonies of Vietnam, back from the embarrassment of the hostages in Iran, and that we now had under his leadership a sense of pride we thought we would never feel again. Proud and free. That was the message, and we loved it. Government wouldn't pester us with regulations. Free enterprise would flourish. The great American tradition of laissez-faire economics would make us more money than ever. And enough would trickle down to take care of the unfortunate. Remember, there'd be safety nets. And we'd balance the budget without raising taxes. And it would be like the good old days, whatever those were. And now, only a few years later, we are assaulted by more scandals and sleaze and cheating and hypocrisy than we know what to do with. Ethics, which had been left to the pulpit, which had been sort of forgotten in business and government and college classrooms, are now all of a sudden at the very center of a new nationwide debate. The 80s, we know, were a time of extraordinary materialism. We talked about the good life, and the good life meant things. And now we're wondering if in the rush for goods, we got left in a kind of vacuum from which principles, standards, integrity had all been excluded. Sisala Bock, a philosophy professor at Brandeis, says what most of us would surely agree with: moral leadership should come from people in public office. I think about that as I look at a page of pictures of 40 different people in government who have faced minor or major allegations of questionable conduct. And again, as I look at another page of pictures of businessmen whose unprincipled greed has led to their downfall and to the ruin of innocent people, not the kind of leadership Mrs. Bock had in mind. On our TV set, we watched the president comfort the families whose hearts were broken by the naval tragedy in the Persian Gulf. And we said to each other, as we have said before on such occasions, that no president in our memory has ever done this kind of thing with more grace. Ronald Reagan can apparently feel the grief of others, especially when he is brought face to face with it, and he responds in a way that makes us like him. No one seems to question the personal decency of this man, yet no one can look at his administration and think of him as a kind of moral father to the nation. Compassion and ethics are not the same. People have a right, we say, to choose their friends, and Mr. Reagan has made it clear that he prefers the company of the wealthy. Robert McFarlane told the New York Times how frustrated he felt being around Shultz and Weinberger and Reagan and Bush, all of whom had made lots of money. "I haven't done that," McFarlane said. "I had a career in the bureaucracy. I didn't really quite qualify." To the extent that his remark is true, and as I have watched and read, it has seemed true to me, there comes a conviction that wealth is the measure of everything. In this great country, if you don't get rich, there must be something wrong with you. One thing that may be wrong is that the government gets in your way with all its rules and regulations. So the theme song has been, "The less government there is, the better." Nothing has appeal unless there is some truth in it. And there is certainly some truth in that theme song. Government interference is often awkward, bumbling, inefficient. So we began the decade of deregulation. From what I read, the statistical result is that the poor got poorer, the rich got richer, the middle class began to shrink. The decade of the entrepreneur, to quote Time, turned into the age of the pinstriped outlaw. White-collar crime has become so pervasive and shocking that there are likely to be fresh doses of regulation. Deregulation, from banking to broadcasting, has made companies feel often that they had to cut corners to keep up. Several airlines, Continental most prominently, have been accused of putting us in danger by cutting back on maintenance. David Reisman, Harvard sociologist, says we no longer have an endowment mentality that asks what we can contribute to an organization. What we now have is a transaction mentality. Now, sociologists are not poets. If they were, they might say this in the simple, concrete language of Jesus. We no longer have people who give their lives away, and in doing so, find life. What we have now are people who think in terms of profits and loss in the ledger book. The idea is so pervasive that even people in Christian ministry who ought to know by heart what Allison read are among some of the worst of all offenders. Jim and Tammy, with their gold-plated bathroom fixtures, with her 50-foot closet lighted by chandeliers, with the millions still missing from all those little checks mailed in by the true believers who think that if the words are right, the deeds must be right too. Now, there are always people who know these things are going on, but who prefer not to say anything. Manville's huge asbestos output, that great health hazard, might have been stopped quite a while ago if certain employees had felt free and safe to speak their concerns. A.H. Robbins' production of the Dalkon Shield, the same. But as a professor of accountancy at the University of Illinois says, people who try to ask the embarrassing questions have a very, very dismal record in succeeding in their later careers. There are still some courageous people who do it anyway. I think of certain engineers at Morton Thiokol who pleaded with their bosses on the night before the launch to tell NASA to cancel. Harvard, I read, now wants to create more such people. It plans to add a course in ethics to the business school curriculum. A new PBS television documentary is underway which examines the tangled state of American ethics, and it may be a good sign of the times that the Parker Brothers board game called Go For It, the game where you can have it all, slashed its prices in one Manhattan store last week from $13.50 to $3. We may need to stop turning people into heroes the moment their improprieties make them notorious. No one knew who Fawn Hall was until she helped Oliver North shred documents and obstruct an investigation. And then, all at once, Farrah Fawcett is on the telephone with a plan to make her the heroine of a movie. And Sidney Biddle Barrows, she of the aristocratic family in Philadelphia, has sold her book about her escort services for $250,000, and Candice Bergen will play her part in a movie about the Mayflower Madam. We are so obsessed by celebrity, no matter how it comes, that every sleazeball and crook must be torn between going undiscovered or getting caught, when the latter sometimes pays off better than the former. Nobody expects ethics to make a comeback until the self-centered hedonism of the last couple of decades is seen to be as destructive as Christ said it was. So far, The gospel preached during almost every television show is, you only go around once in life, so get all the gusto you can. A statement which the president of Boston University says is a statement about theology as much as it is a statement about beer. It's lousy beer, he concludes, and even worse, theology. You'll probably be able to predict when all this begins to turn itself around. Right now, hardly anyone ever admits guilt or shows shame and remorse. When McFarland did it on television, he almost seemed like an oddity. The administration explains the Iran-Contra affair by saying mistakes were made. Notice the passive voice, which is used to suggest they just sort of happened by themselves, like a house creaking in the night when the temperature drops. We'll know we're headed at last in the right direction again when we hear more and more people say, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, I deserve to be punished, I forgot the difference between right and wrong. And that will happen when these words, lost for a long time now in churches, come back on the street. For what good is it for a man to gain the whole world at the price of his own soul? What could a woman offer to buy back her soul once she has lost it? If we are sick and troubled as a people, this is the medicine that can make us well. And what a refreshing thing it is that this time the sermon is coming from a lot of other places besides the pulpit.